You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You want a melting pot, a college football melting pot? This is it, at least digitally. Another edition of the Late Kick Extra podcast, Wednesday, May 25th, the year of our Lord 2022. I'm Josh Pate. We got a loaded mailbag as we do every midweek for you. Our numbers, well, they almost look fake. They're so good. Thank you guys so much for that. We're not wasting a whole lot of time here because we got a lot to get to. Even before we recorded, there was breaking news. We're going to hit all of it. There's a bunch going on in terms of spring meetings, and you have asked about it. And we will discuss. At Late Kick Josh on Twitter, at Late Kick Josh on Instagram. That's how you can get in touch with the show. And with that, less than 45 seconds in, let's dive in. First up, Colt asking, what city do you believe is a melting pot of college football fan bases? Excellent question. Never heard anything like this before. And immediately I had three thoughts. So I had Atlanta, which is an hour north of where I grew up in Columbus, Georgia. Columbus is not it's far behind Atlanta, but it's still a nice, adequate melting pot of regionality. But Atlanta, number one. Of course, I live in Nashville, so Nashville would be up there. And also Charlotte, North Carolina. Those were the three I came up with. But I also know I have not lived in all portions of this great country of ours. And so I asked you guys right before we recorded, I didn't give you a lot of lead time. I asked you on Twitter, at Late Kick Josh, what do you think is the best melting pot city for college football? And we got a lot of Atlanta, Nashville, and Charlotte. But there were some more. See, I would not have thought of Dallas because I've never lived near Dallas. I've never lived in Texas. So Dallas and Houston, excellent suggestions there. And then, of course, any of our Midwestern brethren or people who have visited Chicago in the fall know Chicago's got to be way up there, too. Because I've had a lot of folks from Georgia or Alabama, Auburn, Florida, basically the fan bases I grew up around, who have gone to Chicago, who have either lived there, they got family there, or they visited there, and they've said, you would not believe it, but there's an Alabama bar, or there's a Florida or Georgia bar there. And so I was able to go up there, and I was able to watch us. I was able to watch our team. And in Atlanta, you've got that. Charlotte, I think, is a little more regional in flavor, and you also get a lot more ACC flavor in Charlotte probably than you would in Atlanta. But New Orleans, I came close to putting on this list, but I don't think it's quite as national a melting pot as much as it is regional. Dallas, I think, is national. Houston's pretty national, possibly a little more regional in flair, but we can't include New York or LA because those are melting pots for everything. So if we exclude the big ones on either coast, I think we got to go Atlanta, number one. I think it's the crossroads of college football. I would put probably either Dallas or Nashville, number two, and you can flip-flop them for number two and number three. I think Charlotte's up there, but then Chicago is just a powerhouse. If we don't include Chicago in the same realm of New York and LA, which they would argue they should be, and thus excluded, but if we don't include them, then yeah, then Chicago's got to be up there too. Now, here is my suggestion to you. People threw Miami at me, Orlando. So I want to know which cities did I leave off here? Because I'm going to read the comments on this. We'll put this video up on YouTube. I want to read the comments on this because I think there may be a couple of suggestions I just totally overlooked that maybe aren't the biggest cities in the world, but for whatever unique geographical reasoning, they should populate this list. So I'll look forward to that. Good question, though, to start it off here this morning. Okay, next up, we've got new hires all over the place, you know. We got some big ones. We got some big ones that have also happened over the last 5 or 10 years. So Jared wants to know, Lincoln Riley to USC is the most significant coaching hire since, fill in the blank. He said, just in terms of pure football and overall college football landscape. He's from Garnet Valley, Pennsylvania. I went with Kirby Smart on this. Kirby was hired at Georgia after the 2015 season. Yeah. So he went to Georgia 2016, he's been there 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and then just won the national title last year. Lincoln Riley to USC, I think that's the biggest hire since what we see here with Kirby Smart because of what it triggered in the SEC. See, what do people expect from Lincoln Riley? That's the way we have to frame this. People expect Lincoln Riley to walk into a program in USC that has been a powerhouse before, and even if it hadn't won titles under Pete Carroll, even if it had been the John McKay era since the last time that you saw them rolling, you would know what they're capable of. And you would expect that if the right guy gets in there, then it's going to trigger this wave of success, the likes of which we haven't seen in a generation or two or three. National championships, multiple recruiting classes inside the top five, and the brand will resonate from coast to coast. That's what people expect Lincoln Riley to do at USC. They expect him to do a version of what Pete Carroll was able to do. They just want to maybe sustain it over a longer period of time, right? Well, that's what Kirby Smart has done and is still in the process of doing at Georgia. And just like on the West Coast, if you're a Utah fan or if you're a UCLA fan, on one hand, you want USC to be good because it's good for the conference, but just selfishly, you don't want them to be good because you know they have access to more resources than you do. Thus, your best shot at winning the conference is USC being down. Well, in the South, people thought that way for a long time about Georgia. While Mark Richt was a very good coach, and that's how I classify him, a very good coach, people were comfortable with Mark Richt being at Georgia if you were a Florida fan, if you were a South Carolina fan or an Alabama fan or whatever the case may be, because even though you respected him and you thought he was pretty good, you never thought Mark Richt was going to make Georgia a perennial powerhouse. Yet you knew they could be. It's kind of like Bryant used to talk about Florida back in the day. Like, Bear Bryant's got Alabama rolling, but he used to always talk about the University of Florida. Before they had ever realized their own potential, he would say, if Florida ever gets it figured out, we're all done. Florida eventually got it figured out in the 90s with a guy named Steve Spurrier. And then they showed you again what they're capable of with Urban Meyer in the mid and latter portion of the 2000s. Well, people have always known that about Georgia in the South. People have always known what they could be capable of. And that whole talking point of, well, they haven't won a title since 1980, that never mattered relative to what they were capable of. That just meant they haven't realized the expectation or the possibility. You could say the same thing about Texas A&M. A&M hadn't won a national championship in the modern era. It doesn't mean they can't. They could do it tomorrow. They could do it this year. They've always been capable of it. Well, when Kirby got hired at Georgia, there were some people who mocked it, but they mocked it really as a defense mechanism because secretly they were really terrified that Georgia just nailed it. And they did. History has shown that they have nailed it. And now they do recruit inside the top five every year or better. Now they have shown you they can win a national championship, and now they're looking to put an S. They're looking to pluralize that. And that's what people expect from Lincoln Riley. So I think Lincoln Riley is the biggest hire since Kirby Smart. I think that is the equivalent. And I was trying to search my mind for other examples of this, but I don't know that anyone else has been the equal of what Kirby Smart has accomplished and what people expect Lincoln Riley to accomplish. I think that people have high expectations for Brian Kelly. I think people have high expectations for Brent Venables. I'm not sure that the expectation level nationally, let me put it that way, is the same as it is for Lincoln Riley. Everyone nationally is looking at Lincoln Riley saying, this is what he's got to do or he is viewed as a failure. Fair or not, that's the way this business works. Okay, next up. That one made me think a little bit harder than I wanted to. I'll just be real with you. The next one's an interesting question that I've gotten a lot, so we chose to put it in the show today. And it's about what we do on Saturdays. Now, as you know, the Renaissance Tour took us to, well, all kinds of different cities last week. I was on the road for 16 weeks. One of our friends here asked, would you ever do something like a pregame show for the Late Kick Tour, either something on site or the night before from Murfreesboro, Tennessee? I have thought about different things. We technically did do something on Friday nights. We did Friday Night Lines this past year, which was an Instagram Live gambling chat. That's not like it's permanent. Obviously, we've done the Renaissance Tour. We've done a fall tour 1 year. So it was an infancy stage last year. We want to grow it bigger and better than ever this year with a new name. But my point in answering that is I'm open to things. I have never thought that there's necessarily a need for another Saturday morning product. That's me personally, but if you disagree with that, you're the audience, not me. I just make the show for you guys. I've never felt like that's the product. I've always thought that if I did something on Saturday, if we did something with the show on Saturday, it would be something that was collaborative. Like it would be me working with someone else or someone else working with us and maybe combining brands on something. That's just me spitballing. There's nothing in the works. If there was, I would either tell you or shut up totally about it. But that's been my vision. So that's a very short answer, intentionally. No, there's not anything immediately, but it doesn't mean we would never do anything. The Friday night is probably more likely than the Saturday morning. Like, as our audience grows, exponentially, apparently, is just the way it's going to grow now. As our audience grows, it becomes more feasible, since we're going to be in town on Friday anyway, to do Friday night events. That's something I could easily see us executing. Got to get a nice sponsor's brand to slap on the side of that tour, but I could see us doing that. So a good question, just stay tuned, I guess, is the answer there. All right, let's get back into the more drama-filled aspects of the sport over the past week or so. Next up, from Erie, Colorado, everybody assumes the A&M versus Bama game in Tuscaloosa will be a curb stomping by Alabama. How do you see it with the added drama? I don't think the added drama changes what the outcome's going to be on the field. If you expect a curb stomping by Alabama, if Nick Saban's in that mood, okay, and if Alabama really is just that much better than A&M this year, there's one way this could change. And I would hearken you back to 2020, the COVID year. Remember when the previous season was the year of Joe Burrow and Ed Orgeron upset Bama? They did a lot of talking in the locker room afterwards. Well, the following year, LSU sucked water through a garden hose. They were terrible. But didn't matter to Bama. Bama goes to Death Valley. They're favored by like 30 points. We gave it out as a best bet on the show because I had heard people in that program, not fans, I mean people inside the program, talk for all off. Ooh, I almost said the O word. Very close to being fined by me. All offseason, I heard people at Alabama say, it doesn't matter how bad they are, how good we are, doesn't matter what the spread is, we will do terrible, terrible things to them. And they went in there like it was the Super Bowl, even though they were favored by 30, and they could have scored 100 that night if they wanted to. They had like 45 or 50 at the half. Well, anyway, I don't think the gap exists like that between Bama and A&M is my point. But if Bama were to start to pull away in this game this year, which I don't necessarily expect that kind of game, but if they were, I think it would probably be a case where Saban may add a 7 or a 14 spot more than he normally would. But I don't expect that. What I do expect is the build-up to the game, the marquee around the game, will be very reminiscent of some of those classic Alabama-LSU games. Because Bama-LSU was the biggest rivalry in the SEC for a long time. It meant every bit as much to the landscape as Alabama-Auburn did. It meant more to the landscape than Bama-Auburn did because these two teams were perennial contenders more frequently than Auburn was. Bama's a contender every year. Take yourself to late September. Take yourself to early October. Let's say both of these teams are undefeated or they have a maximum of one loss. That means you have conference championship implications and playoff implications, of course. But you also have, for a full week or two or three, the repeat of the snippets that happened over the past week, playing on pod and TV and radio and everywhere in between. You will not be able to escape it. Who or whomst amongst us knows what's going to happen additionally between now and then? I think it will be one of the more charged environments that we've seen in a while. Because previously, if you really think about it, the big games Alabama's played, what have they consisted of? For the storyline crowd out there, what have the big games Bama's been in consisted of? They've played Clemson. That consisted of a team capable of beating them. That's about it. They've played Georgia. That's a team capable of beating them. That's about it. My point is, normally a big Alabama game just means that they're facing someone that's capable of beating them. And they're capable enough where it's gotten the nation's attention. It's never personal, though. Because historically, Nick Saban has not been involved in public personal feuds. Well, he is now. He is. And so now we add that in, and I think it's going to be a unique feel around the game. It's still several months away, but you have all the competitive fire, and then you also have a dude leading a program in Jimbo Fisher that said a lot of things about you. He didn't allege him. He just outright said them that we've never heard publicly before. Aside from message boards, we've never heard actual powerful people like coaches traffic in that kind of, to steal a line from Conrad Thompson, rumor and innuendo. Well, it's here now. So I think it's going to be very juicy. It's going to be a very, very heated early October. I'm glad we don't have to wait until November for it. Sometimes I'm glad we don't have to wait until 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. for kickoffs. Which leads us to our next question. It's very near and dear to my heart. A lot of you hate it. That's okay. Marcus said, this question is strictly for the in-game experience. Do you feel the big noon kickoff puts a damper on some games' stadium atmospheres versus a 7:30 primetime spot from Youngstown, Ohio? I think it can. And to kind of push it back and give the context here. Selfishly, I have gone on record as saying I love the noon kickoff because the noon kickoff lets me get out of town and get back home if I'm covering the game. However, I have, prior to getting in this line of work, been a fan and sitting in the bleachers with you guys, and I did not like the noon kickoff, so I understand the sentiment. I always rooted for the primetime kickoff, probably because I could just leave the stadium afterwards. I didn't have to stay there another 2 hours. Yes, it's a tough life I live. My point with this is it's a case-by-case situation. There's this blanket assumption that a noon kickoff equals a damp atmosphere, and I don't find that. For instance, Texas and OU know they're kicking off at 11 a.m. Central, noon Eastern every year, and that place is on fire. I went last year. You will not find a better atmosphere in college football. So the clock doesn't matter there. How do they pull that off? Well, they pull it off because they've conditioned themselves to understand that that's part of it. The noon kickoff, 11 a.m. kickoff, that's part of it, and they conditioned themselves. I think that's the key. I was at Ohio State, Michigan this past year. Noon kickoff, snow coming down, place was on fire. That game kicks off at noon almost every year, I believe. Does it dampen the atmosphere? When you hear people talk about the game, Ohio State, Michigan, when you hear people talk about the Red River Shootout, do they talk about how much better the atmosphere could be? ... No, they don't say it like that. That would be ludicrous. If you just watched replays of the games on YouTube and you didn't know what kickoff time was, you'd never be able to tell it was a noon kickoff. The sunlight would be one key indicator, but for all you know, it could be 3:30. The point is, it's case by case. Yeah, if I turn on sometimes a random Wisconsin game and it's a noon kickoff and the stadium's not full yet, it's a late arriving crowd. Yeah, I would say a noon kickoff probably dampened that atmosphere relative to what an 8 p.m. or 7 p.m. primetime kick would do. But it doesn't have to be that way, is my point. I love games being played under natural light. Maybe I'm a weirdo. Maybe that's the exception to the rule, but here's what else I've seen. And I don't know how much you guys agree with me on this. I know some of you would fight to the death on this topic, but I don't think there's as much appeal to the primetime kickoff as there used to be. When ABC, this is a while back. If you're in college, you don't remember this. A while back, it's been over a decade ago now, when ABC started that primetime kickoff package, when ABC took their A game and they moved it from 3:30 to 8 p.m. or 7 p.m., whenever it is, that was a huge deal. And when you got that game, it was such a big deal to be playing under the lights. ESPN had been having the 7:45 Eastern time primetime kick, and it was a big deal to be in that game. But it's because there weren't a whole lot of night games. Now everybody plays at night. The SEC Network has like Tier 3 and Tier 4 games at night. It used to just be your Tier 1, like, circle it with red Sharpie game was the primetime game, and it was an honor to be there. Now I got Vanderbilt in South Carolina playing at 7 p.m. It doesn't mean what it used to mean. Therefore, it doesn't have the appeal to me that it used to have. So I don't make a big deal about primetime kicks. And then I get the selfish side of me that wants the earlier kicks. But no, I don't think you have to lose an ounce of luster as it relates to your in-game atmosphere just because of what the clock says when toe meets leather. I don't think that way at all. We move on. Hot three letters here. The hottest three letters in college football, unfortunately. NIL. This is Bill. He said, I'm born and raised in Montgomery. I'm now in Phoenix, not Phoenix City, Phoenix, Arizona. Do you believe an unintended consequence of NIL is coaches being on the hot seat faster than ever before? This is a really good question. For example, will those boosters at A&M stand for spending that amount of money on NIL for more 8-4 seasons? Well, Bill, Jimbo said NIL has nothing to do with it. And so we're going to leave it at that. We're going to speak very generically. I think the answer to this is yes. I think it's absolutely going to change the timetable with which success is expected to happen. But, Bill, that's not the only thing that's happening here. You have got to work transfer portal in. So think about NIL and the transfer portal as just kind of conjoined within the aspect of how coaches are viewed now. Here's what I mean by that. If you're Lincoln Riley and you're hired at USC and you're inheriting a program under Clay Helton that it wasn't operating at peak efficiency, we all understand that. Let's be real. So in 1997, if you were to inherit that program, the going theology would be, okay, we're going to give you couple, 3 years before we really hold you to the SC standard. Well, these days, you have NIL, true, but what else do you have at your disposal? What is Lincoln Riley leveraging even as we speak in Southern California? He is leveraging the transfer portal, capital T, capital P. And so when you combine the portal and the ability to do what USC has done, and that is bring in, I think the last count was 17 kids. I have to keep track because it changes by the day. When you can flip that large a chunk of your roster before you've ever even coached a game, then yes, it absolutely is going to expedite the timetable of expectations that your fan base has. No longer, including Brian Kelly, including Brent Venables, including Lincoln Riley, no longer is a coach going to be able to walk in and meet with boosters and meet with donor groups all across the state and stand in front of them behind a podium and say, I look forward to 2 or 3 years where we can really get a viable product on the field for you. That's not going to fly anymore. And here's what's really going to ruin it. It's not even as bad as it's going to get yet, because no one's won a conference championship in year one under this era yet. But you mark my words, I think this is going to be the year, actually. It could be Venables, it could be Lincoln Riley, it could be Billy Napier, for all I know. One of these first-year head coaches is going to have hit the portal just right, and the schedule and bounces of balls are going to work out just right to where they go to a conference championship and maybe even win it in year one. That example, although it should be an outlier to anyone with common sense, will be used against new head coaches until the end of time, and it will be held up as this example of what's possible and therefore what you should be capable of. If Lincoln Riley did this at USC in year one, if Brian Kelly did this, if whoever, and I'm filling the blank, if whoever did this at whatever program in year one, you should be able to do it. That's going to happen. If not this year, it's eventually going to happen. So that's a matter of when, not if. And then it's really going to get uncomfortable. Now, as you know, microwave mentality doesn't really work as a viable long-term approach to success, but there's a large enough group of people out there who believe if you throw enough money at something, then you can just artificially enhance expectations and it makes sense. Well, that's not reality, but yet it is reality. That's the way it's going to be, whether it should be that way or not. And therefore, you and I just have to live in this world and sit behind this microphone and talk about it. I think we can manage. Next up, this is going to evolve. Okay, I hesitate to even go down this road because it's going to evolve next week. But DaKing checks in from Birmingham, Alabama. He said, what are your thoughts on the talks that circulated yesterday, today if we're recording, about the SEC potentially starting its own playoff within the conference? Well, my thoughts are, That's kind of what my thoughts were to begin with. But in a more real sense, I wasn't surprised by it. You need to understand something. There is a term, cerebral. They used to refer to Triple H in wrestling as the cerebral assassin. Well, Greg Sankey, not going to go as far as to call him an assassin, although he could be killing a lot of hopes out there right now, but he is very cerebral. He does not show his cards, which is noteworthy because if you've paid attention, if you've had your ear to the ground of college athletics, ever since the playoff went up in smoke, Greg Sankey has not tried to hide the fact that he's mad. And let me give you a little behind-the-scenes access. If Greg Sankey is willing to let you know he's a little aggravated, it means behind the scenes he is livid and probably breaking furniture in the conference office in downtown Birmingham. With that in mind, we get to what was just referenced here. Pete Thamel of ESPN.com now, got to get used to saying that, Pete Thamel had a story on Monday that indicated, and it was well-sourced, I can promise you that, it had Greg Sankey on the record in the article, and it referenced the possibility that as they head into the SEC spring meetings in Destin next week, we could emerge with anything from a reworked conference schedule to an approach where the SEC just decides they want to have their own playoff. You may scoff at that or laugh at that and think that's just a threat tactic. It's not. The SEC doesn't have to use scare tactics. The SEC is, they are the elephant in the room. By a mile. If you ever want to use the phrase, and it's not even close, use it here. SEC running the show, and it's not even close. They don't have to hoodwink anyone. They just get to do whatever they want to do, and then everyone has to react. Previously, even though I wasn't on board with it, previously Greg Sankey and the SEC were willing to make some concessions in order to enter into, mutually with other conferences, a 12-team playoff model. But enough conference commissioners stood up against it to where Greg Sankey essentially walked away from the table. And if you understand the attitude he walked away with, you understand why that Pete Thamel article said what it said. Greg Sankey was almost taken aback. Greg Sankey was like, hold up, we don't have to help you at all. My conference is already dominating. In a four-team model, we're dominating. We don't need to change. We're already making more money than the rest of you, and we just entered into a new media rights agreement. So the SEC, they're going to be making $100 million a year plus per institution regardless. Greg Sankey looked at it and said, all right, because we like college football, and it does stand to benefit us too, we will try to execute this with you in good faith. But when they walked away from the table, Greg Sankey said, forget this, burn it to the ground. And now he's looking out for the best interest of his conference. How do I feel about this? Of course, you know I hate it all. But this is why I've always told you guys. It has been my approach, and follow me if you want to, I can assure you it's a lot happier over here. It has been my approach to cherish the regular season. Anything they give you in the postseason is whatever they give you in the postseason. But the regular season is what's great about this sport. And as long as we don't completely torpedo that, the playoff is what the playoff is. So if the SEC wants to have their own playoff, I'll watch it, I'll cover it, we'll talk about it, we'll benefit from it, yada, yada, yada. I don't have to necessarily be in love with any of it, but I understand there is some seismic shift coming. So anyone out there who just hopes that all of this blows over, it's impossible. We're well past the point of no return on that. So something big's coming. Multiple somethings are coming. I don't even think Greg Sankey and the power players know exactly what that is yet. That's why I told you I hesitate to speak about it. Because anytime you ask someone in a decision-making position about this stuff, they hem-haw around, to steal a phrase from Meemaw, and they shrug their shoulders, and really what they're telling you is, I don't know. It's like alphabet soup right now. You're going to dip the spoon in there. You don't know which words you're going to draw out yet. But you know, there are certain words in there that are more likely to be drawn out. For instance, I'm probably going to get and more often than I get atmosphere. Something big's coming, though. And it wouldn't shock me at all if the SEC ended up going this route. I'm not going to say I don't care, because I do care. I've just resigned myself to the fact that something's going to happen. Therefore, I'm going to hang out in the regular season. And if you so choose to traffic in all the rumors about postseason and you choose to put your hope in the postseason, you guys go ahead. You know that's not my club. That's not where I hang out. We love Saturdays in the fall. I love the any given Saturday approach to college football. I don't like, well, let's make sure we keep one eye on the postseason. Even though we're September 18th, let's make sure we look at January. I'm not about that. I would rather not know what's around the corner, just like you didn't know that this was around the corner.
Introducing the two-way V4, where groundbreaking fuel cell technology meets fresh foam cushioning for the ultimate performance. With fuel cell, each step feels explosive, delivering unparalleled energy return. Paired with fresh foam, experience maximum comfort throughout the game. Its lightweight textile upper offers support and breathability without sacrificing agility. Whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the two-way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the two-way for yourself at newbalance.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I don't know if they have a Hall of Fame for ad tosses, but if they do, that one's going in there. All right, the big bad ad toss out of the way. Let's get back to things. Andy hit us up. Big news here. Excited to hear about Eli Holstein committing to Alabama, but does that essentially rule out Arch Manning from Scottsboro, Alabama? Well, there's a lot to unpack here. So if you're listening on Wednesday, yesterday, Eli Holstein, four-star quarterback for the class of 2023, committed to Alabama. Now, this is very noteworthy. Number one, because anytime Bama takes a quarterback, it's noteworthy because they essentially have their pick of whoever they want. So Eli Holstein is a four-star quarterback. He's top 100 kid nationally, big, 6'4", 220. So he's full grown already. Now, obviously Alabama had been in the running for Arch Manning. And so there's a lot of thought out there, connecting the dots, so to speak, that once they've taken him, they being Alabama, then Arch Manning must be out of the running and it must be down to like a one or a two-team race and Texas takes the lead. I happen to share that philosophy, so I do believe that. I don't believe, in other words, that Arch Manning and Eli Holstein are going to be in the Alabama signing class. I always thought that was going to be one or the other. I can tell you that Steve Wiltfong, our National Director of Recruiting, even as we're recording here, he reached out to Arch Manning's coach, and they said regarding the official visit that Arch Manning is going to take to Alabama, nothing has changed on that front. A visit does not mean a commitment, obviously. So I think that this does mean a lot. And I also think it means a lot on the Alabama side of things. You know, Alabama's squarely in the mix for Arch Manning. I think what this screams is they felt comfortable enough that the evaluation was comparable enough. They had these two guys classified similarly enough that they were willing to give both of them committable offers, and they were willing to say the first one who takes it gets it. It's not that they would turn down Arch Manning at this point, but they're realists like I am and probably understand they're not getting both. My point is, if they had Arch Manning evaluated at such a higher level than Eli Holstein, they would not have taken Eli Holstein's commitment right now. They would have waited it out. They easily would have waited until the regular season gets here or until fall gets here and maybe even into December. They didn't. They took Eli Holstein's commitment now. And what that means is they are willing to say goodbye to Arch Manning if that's what this means, which should tell you all you need to know about how highly Alabama evaluated Eli Holstein. I was over on Bama Online, and you know the last thing in this world I want to do is credit Tim Watts for anything. But let me credit Tim Watts. They've been all over this over on Bama Online, and they've been able to keep you up to date on the inner workings and the inner thoughts inside the program of how that evaluation process has worked out and the entire recruiting process. And I was reading some of his kind of post-commitment nuggets over there on the roundtable on Bama Online, and he was talking about this. He was talking about how, hey, the evaluation was such that they were willing to take him now. And Eli Holstein is an all-in kind of kid. They don't have to worry about him decommitting. They don't expect that to be a problem. It's never a guarantee. But now we get to reassess the Arch Manning sweepstakes. And Texas has got to feel good about this. You also don't know if any other players could get involved. By players, I mean teams, could get involved. So, yeah, I don't think there's any two ways about this. Bama taking this commitment is a very big deal. Saw Pete Golding, the defensive coordinator, ironically, was very influential and a key player in this recruitment. You know, right now, I don't know how many people even realize this, but Bill O'Brien is the offensive coordinator there, entering his second year. He was big on that eval, obviously, because he coaches the quarterback position and runs the offense. So they feel good about it. And if they feel good about it, then I think they're comfortable with the dominoes just falling accordingly as it relates to Arch Manning. But big pickup there. I mean, I'm glad it happened right before we started recording. William next up. And William asks a question about week one. A lot of you want to know. What game has the most implications for a team's season in week one? From Bentonia, Mississippi. Well, I got several here. As you know, I'm notoriously bad at narrowing down to just one. But the week one slate, some of it's just outright good, some of it's sneaky good. So you could go Notre Dame, Ohio State, but I think that that one is bigger for Ohio State. If Ohio State were to fall in that game, think about what that would mean. That would mean that a lot of what you expected probably did not pan out. I mean, because Ohio State has the edge almost everywhere in that game. They got home field. They've got a racehorse stable of wide receivers. They may end up having the best running back in the country in Travion Henderson. They have got maybe the best quarterback in the country in C.J. Stroud. They are loaded, and they have all the reason in the world to come out with their hair on fire. If they were to lose that game, it probably means defense wasn't at the caliber that we thought it would be under Jim Knowles, and however it happened, it happened. It would be a crippling blow to Ohio State to lose that one in the opener. Notre Dame can afford to lose that game and still be okay. So that would be a lot bigger loss for Ohio State. Also, you could look at the Oregon-Georgia game. And this one's big. It's big for both programs. It would be a very, very big point spread upset if Georgia lost. But Georgia's coming off a national championship. So I mean, yeah, I mean, that wouldn't matter to the folks in Conyers, Georgia, if they lost in week one. They don't care about what they did accomplish. They care about what's coming up. But for Oregon, you could say the same for Utah and Florida. If Oregon and or Utah won those games in week one, and certainly if both of them won in week one, how huge would that be for the Pac-12? All of a sudden, you would have wins against two marquee SEC programs in their backyard, one in their building and the other essentially in their building away from their building in Atlanta. That would be really big. But I'm also thinking about some maybe off-the-radar national games. Did you know that Cincinnati goes to Arkansas in week one? Cincinnati, most recently seen in the college football playoff, yes. And then more recently seen sending nine guys to the NFL draft. Yes, they open at Arkansas. Arkansas is a preseason favorite of a lot of peoples, and peoples plural there. And they also have an opportunity here in week one to do a couple of things. If Cincinnati lost that game, you always have the assumption a G5 team has to be undefeated to make the playoff. So that would be a big blow for Cincinnati. But for Arkansas, I think there's a lot on the line there because that line is 7.5. This is not some huge spread. Arkansas has all the hope and confidence in the world right now. They need that game. They, with what they have to face in conference, they have to win that game. So that's another big one. But there are other games, you know, that I don't think, for example, Clemson-Georgia Tech is on anyone's radar on Monday night. That's Labor Day night. And with good reason. The line is between like 17 and 20 for Clemson. But what if Clemson got upset? I just throw it out there. It's not a prediction. What if Clemson got upset? Do you know, number one, what that would do for the talk or the perception around Clemson football? But then also, in the very next breath, think about what that does. Well, it does a ton for Georgia Tech, but what does it do for the ACC? If before week one ends, the ACC is already wide open again, then imagine being an NC State fan, or imagine being a Miami fan or a Florida State fan for that matter. Everybody would have hope immediately. And also, there's this little Sunday night game in New Orleans between FSU and LSU. And I'm not going in any particular order here, obviously. This is a big one for both teams. You know, LSU, they have got a super tough back half of their season. It's imperative. If they want to make a bowl game or better, they need to be starting 4-0. And you can't start 4-0 if you start 0-1. I did the math on that. But for Florida State, too, they're going in here as a 2.5-point to a 3-point dog. It's in LSU's backyard. But it's a game where you're several years in now to your coaching staff being there and your way of doing things. You're facing a new staff. Pull one off. Pull off an upset. If you want to signify that the program is headed in the right direction, you've got an opportunity there to pull off an upset. So those are some of the games I'm looking at. But there are several more out there that are just off that national radar. I mean, you know, you've got some teams that have big week two games that shouldn't be overlooking anything in week one. So I'm just ready for it. I'm ready to watch Nebraska-Northwestern in week zero. I'm just ready for it to be here. We will make it together. Let's get to our last question here. This last question is personal to me and doesn't mean anything to you, but if you followed me for a long time, if you have followed Late Kick for a long time, and specifically you followed the Instagram story for a long time, you may have seen from time to time, back in the day, Friday night, a video. Probably had my feet propped up, probably had a certain song playing in the background. And so there was a question from one of you about the ritual that I have referenced actually on the show from time to time. It's from Eugene, Oregon. That's the question. He said, I'm a big fan of the show. Could you retell the story about the ritual you and your coworkers used to have of listening to Holding Back the Years after a long day of work? I adopted that ritual myself. Great story for new listeners. First off, that is great news, so I definitely think it's a ritual worth adopting. I'm not quite sure why we chose the song we chose, but I was down in Columbus. I was at WLTZ. We were a distant number three in the market. That was not going to change. We had just institutional brands there, and we were a new brand. So that wasn't going to change. But let me tell you, we had a loaded talent roster there, as it turns out. We had more fun than I've ever had anywhere professionally in my life. The trade-off for being the number three in the market was the station was a little more loose. You could get away with doing things there that you couldn't get away with at the other places in town. So we would stage ping pong tournaments right there in the news studio. After the show, management would leave. You'd watch their taillights disappear up the hill, and then you would push the news desk out of the way. It's on rollers. And we would bring ping pong tables in. I mean, we would have like full-on parties there on Fridays. We would invite people, totally illegal. We would invite people to the station. Well, anyway, before all that, what we would do on Friday nights, after our ping pong tournaments, when we dried the sweat off and we got ready, about 10:50 p.m., right before our 11 p.m. newscast, we would all gather in the studio, and to signify the end of what had always been a grueling work week, because everyone there was carrying the load of about 2.5 or 3 men, we would listen to the song Holding Back the Years by Simply Red. It was remade for the movie Love and Basketball, some of you may know, but Simply Red, I think, had the best version, Holding Back the Years. And we would play it, and the rule was you had to sit in total silence throughout the duration of the song and just reflect. It looked kind of like a scene in a TV show or a movie. It didn't look like something that normal people would be doing in real life. But then again, a lot of things we did at that station back in the day did not look like something you would do in real life. I came across a video the other day, I'm not making any of this up, where when we were doing what ended up being Late Kick in the very infancy of the show, one time we did it live. So one time right before the show, we found out there was a snake, live snake in the studio, and we couldn't do anything about it. We had to go on air. So we're on air with the snake in the studio. It was a cottonmouth, by the way. Those are poisonous. And so we, during commercial breaks, would try to go kill the snake. Unsuccessful. So we end up doing the entire 30-minute show, 22 minutes with ads. And then we get off the air, and my co-host, my esteemed co-host named Jonathan Rivers down there, he tried to kill the snake again, failed miserably. Long story short, we end up rescuing the snake and taking it out in the parking lot. Probably not even a top 5 story in my time there. A lot of the stuff can't be told on air. But yes, Holding Back the Years, I strongly recommend. If you need to unwind, if you just need to sit in silence for 3 or 4 minutes, just lean back, pull up Holding Back the Years, let the ad play if you haven't subscribed to YouTube Premium or pull it up on Spotify, and just listen and reflect on all that has happened this past week and all that could happen in the future for you. Do you know what's happening with us? What's happening with us? And I waited till the end to tell you this. I don't want to brag, but it's you. It's not me, so I'll brag on you. You know we're ranked in the top 6 worldwide in football podcasts right now. It's us and a bunch of NFL shows that probably have very, very fat marketing budgets. We have no marketing budget. We've never spent money on the show before. So I appreciate that a whole lot. Thank you guys for that. As I told you before, if you keep doing that, it'll make a lot of things possible. Well, you're doing it, and now a lot of things are being unlocked because of that. As you can tell in my language, I'm closer and closer and closer every week to being able to inform you of things. And I hope I haven't been unclear on that. So stay tuned. Keep sharing the show. Keep telling friends and family and everywhere in between about the show, and we will keep producing the show as you want us to. For Director Colin, for Producer Jesse, for our entire staff and crew here, I'm Josh Pate. Have yourselves a great rest of your week. We'll see you Thursday night on the 24/7 Sports YouTube channel for Late Kick Live. Until then, take care, have a great day, and God bless.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.